Jack silently thanked the Parademdron who had saved them from the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Saved him.
That's right. Annie put the dinosaur back with the other books. Then she gasped. Wow, she whispered, look at this.
Dreams, books, are each a world, and books, we know, are a substantial world, both pure and good. That according to William Wordsworth. Logan Pearsall Smith had this to say on the topic. People say that life is the thing, but I prefer reading. I can agree with that. The Tiger Eye Reading Room is a dedicated space on the ground floor of Townsend Hall on the University of Missouri campus. In the reading room, youth services librarians in training and early childhood educators create story times for preschoolers enrolled in the Child Development Lab program. It's a magical experience that does not translate into statistics or outcome measures or any other quantifiable evaluation system, but it is a microcosm of and almost complete justification for the entire cycle of authorship, publishing, reading, and librarianship. The Tiger Eye Reading Room series of interviews and discussions brings together all aspects of this cycle. We will be talking to authors, readers, booksellers, children, reading adults, and the occasional librarian or two. We'll try and look at all aspects of the world of books and see what connections can be made or different viewpoints expressed. This interview was originally done at the annual conference of the American Library Association in New Orleans, June of 2006. Like any convention, there are lots of people about, so there's a fair amount of ambient noise in the background. Only once did it get bad enough that I had to pause the recording before we could progress. ALA annuals are huge, cumbersome, usually in hot places, but also serve as a wonderful chance to talk to authors, publishers, and the folks who attend the meetings. The New Orleans meeting was no exception, and we got some excellent interviews out of the trip. As you will hear, this interview was in two parts. Ms. Kahn and I managed to get crosswired on our meeting spot, so by the time we caught up with each other, her schedule made for a very short, if interesting, interview on the ground in New Orleans. We followed up on the phone about 3 weeks later, and that's the second part of the conversation. We're almost to the last waltz here in New Orleans. It's Sunday. We're sitting with Roxana Kahn, who is both Canadian and Muslim and has written a book entitled Muslim Child, Understanding Islam Through Stories and Poems. And I think, you know, if the kids were had it all in their hands, the world would be in great shape. So tell me about the book and what were your thoughts when you were writing it?
Basically, I wrote this book to answer a lot of questions that people might have about Islam. They might be too shy to ask them, well, why do you wear that thing on your head? Why do you pray 5 times a day? All these kinds of things. They would be wondering about these things, but maybe too shy to ask. So I answered these questions in the book. But I tried to make the stories really engaging for children, because personally, I can't stand how boring some multicultural books are. And I didn't want to go that route. Yeah. So the first story in the book, what I did, I made each story about a major aspect of the faith through a child's eyes. Not in a preachy way, but just more in a way to understand their experience. And so the first story deals with the prayer. Like that's like the after belief, that's like the second pillar of Islam. And I thought, how can I make this engaging? And I thought, okay, we have to pray 5 times a day. And the first prayer is really early in the morning. It's called Fajr. It's before sunrise. You got to get out of your warm, cozy bed and go wash up and pray. And before we pray, we have to wash a lot. We have to wash our hands 3 times, mouth 3 times, nose 3 times, face 3 times, right arm to the elbow 3 times, left arm to the elbow 3 times. We wet our hair, we clean our ears, we wash our right foot to the ankle 3 times, and our left foot to the ankle 3 times. And if you fart or go to the bathroom, you have to go back and wash again. And I thought, okay, I got this boy. He's waking up for Fajr. He's grumbly, thinking, oh, gosh, it would be easier not to be Muslim. So he goes and he makes wudu, which is the washing, and he goes and he starts to pray. And in the middle of the prayer, he's got a big problem. He's got to fart. But he's almost done, and he thinks, you know, let me just squeeze and hope nothing slips out. So he spends most of the prayer saying the words so fast, they're like a blur on his tongue. And just before he's almost finished, it happens.
Yeah.
No more need to squeeze.
Kids are going to relate to that.
Oh, thank
oh
you.
My God.
No
yeah.
more need to squeeze. Yeah. No more need to rush. His prayer is ruined. But it was so quiet. Maybe it didn't count. So he goes ahead, finishes his prayer like nothing happened. And he says, he finishes his prayer. And his sister is glaring at him like, you know.
She
and
knew.
She says, and he goes, what, what? She goes, oh, you're so gross. I heard you. Go back and make wudu again. So he goes, oh, man. So he goes back and he looks at the washroom and he's like, forget it. I'm not going to pray again. I already prayed. That's enough. And so he shuts off the tap. He listens at her door. And she's fast asleep, snoring. And he thinks, okay, I'm just going to go back to bed. Now, he spends about an hour tossing and turning. His conscience is bothering him. And finally, he looks at the clock. He thinks, oh, forget it. I'm never going to be able to sleep. I might as well go and wash up and pray again. So this time, he takes his time. And when he's done, he starts saying his prayers, his praises. He's going, glory be to God, glory be to God. And he looks out in the corner, and he sees the window, and the sun is starting to rise. It's very pretty. The sky is all rosy. The grass is sparkling with dew. And it's really pretty. So he grabs a book and a blanket, and he goes out onto the porch to watch the sunrise. And that's where his father finds him 2 hours later. He's fast asleep with a Quran, which is our holy book, in his hand. It's actually a story about spiritual awakening, okay, even though it deals with a part. But to me, like, it's relevant because I think a lot of religion really is about controlling the physical, like controlling physical urges, all that kind of stuff in service of the spiritual. So
yeah,
you kind of have that going for
it.
Kids
are certainly going to love this story.
Well, the whole book, what I tried to do, each of the stories is like that.
Yeah.
And it has nonfiction sidebars that explain all of the religious terms in the story.
Yeah.
So it's accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
It is.
You're hoping maybe some adults read it as well?
Well, you know, actually, it's funny to say because a lot of adults have read it. And
yeah.
I have received emails from all kinds of people, Christians, Jews, Muslims, that have thanked me for writing this book. They've really enjoyed it.
Well, it's good. I think anything to lessen stereotypes, hopefully lessen tensions. I mean, it's not a particularly happy time right at the moment.
Right now, it's quite difficult to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you get any reaction to that? I mean, I can't. I like to think such things aren't going to happen in Canada. I'm all too suspicious they might happen in this country.
Canada was brutal growing up. Like
really?
Oh, yeah. In the 60s, the kids in my class, they used to tell me, this is what they thought. They used to say, well, we're white because we're clean, and you're brown because you're dirty. They said, if you go home and take a lot of baths, you'll get white like us. Now, me and my sisters, we would have done anything to fit in, so we actually tried it.
Yeah.
We did.
Yeah.
I mean, they were really, really brutal. It was about as bad as you can get. But you know what they, you know, Nietzsche says? He says that what doesn't kill you
makes
you
stronger.
Strong.
Right,
exactly.
right.
Yeah.
My father-in-law immigrated from Trinidad and Tobago. Now, he's white, leftover wreckage of the British Empire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they were in Canada first, but he moved to the United States. And, of course, he has that Caribbean accent. And I guess they had quite a hard time at various points.
I can imagine. Actually, my husband's from the Caribbean.
Is
he? He's from Guyana.
Yeah.
South America. Absolutely.
So you really wonder sometimes how all this is going. And I know you're in a rush here, so we're going to thank you for talking to us. Good luck with the book. I hope it does something to ease even a little tension somewhere.
It already has.
I'm glad to hear it. So thanks so much for being with
us.
Thank
you.
So here we are once more talking to Roxana Khan, author of Muslim Child. As you heard in the original bit a few minutes ago, we got cut short in New Orleans, and it's now 3 weeks later, and I definitely wanted to follow up on the conversation. And Roxana, thanks for coming back and talking to us on the phone.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
It was, as I said a couple of minutes ago, it was far too interesting a conversation to let go at just the six-minute point. But in our original conversation, you were talking very, very briefly. You mentioned your dissatisfaction with what's termed multicultural books or multiculturalism books. You want to comment on that a little bit and tell me where that opinion came from?
Well, I guess it just comes from the child in me, because when I was growing up, I didn't read books in order to learn anything, in order to learn about other cultures or anything like that. I would not have picked up a multicultural book the way they are portrayed these days. I just wouldn't have. What I always looked for were strong stories. And yet, going back to some of my favorites growing up, many of them were multicultural. One of my favorites was called Shadow of a Bull by Maya Wojciechowska, which was about a bullfighter named Manolo. And it was definitely set in Hispanic culture in Spain. And yet, it wasn't what I would have called a multicultural book because it wasn't like, preachy. It wasn't didactic. It wasn't the kind of book that says, oh, yes, let's understand each other. It was just a good story, and I could relate to it.
Well, all the really good stories don't swipe you upside the head, I think. You know, kids don't need to be hit with a 2x4 to get
the point.
Oh,
no, not at all. Yeah.
So, I was trying to think about the things I read as a kid that might be considered multicultural, I guess, and Ferdinand the Bull pops to mind right off the bat. You must have read that one somewhere.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call that multicultural. Any story that deals with animals, mm-hmm. anthropomorphic animals, I wouldn't necessarily call that a multicultural story, even if it's set in another culture. One of them I can remember, though, was called Call It Courage. And that was set somewhere in the Polynesian Islands. But what I noticed, too, about a lot of multicultural literature that's written by, for want of a better term, white people, is that a lot of the stuff that was, when I was growing up, it involved people from that culture going outside the bounds of their cultural reasoning. And that kind of irritates me as a person of a different culture, because mm-hmm. one of the stories I remember reading was about a tribe, like a Native American tribe, who don't eat fish. They think fish is appalling. They go through a famine, and there's nothing else to eat, so finally the protagonist breaks with tradition, and she catches fish. Okay? I mean, it was really quite condescending. I just thought, if I was a Native person reading this, I would feel really insulted that, okay, it's that obvious, yeah, okay, when we're hungry, we're going to eat something that we would consider, you know, taboo, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And really coming from it, it's like the whole idea of looking at the mote in your brother's eye, where mm-hmm. some of the multicultural literature is really actually written for want of a better term, white people, to feel better about themselves. Oh, look how civilized we are. We've kind of gone beyond these issues, and they're still dealing with them kind of thing. And yet, when you actually go in depth into the whole cultural logic and the way they think, they've set things up in terms of a cultural reasoning that it's actually, once you're inside the culture, it's quite hard to break out of. And that's something I find lacking in a lot of multicultural literature that's written by people from outside the culture.
Mm-hmm. So, in essence, the being from the Southwest, I'd say the gringos,
mm-hmm.
white authors are in the final analysis, sort of imposing white cultural values on these allegedly. Brown skin, you know, other cultures.
Yeah, they are, and a lot of the literature is actually there to prop up white cultural values. These kind of I was looking, for example, there was an article in Publishers Weekly. This happened after September 11th. Somebody was saying, "Well, where are the books on Islam? How come we don't have many books on Islam?" I said, "Wait a minute. I've got my books out there. How come you know, I'm a Muslim author. Mm-hmm. I've got my books out. How come you haven't been paying attention to my books?" And the ones that get, and I started noticing a trend, that the books that get the most publicity about other cultures are books that in some way make the mainstream people, like make normal North Americans feel better about themselves by focusing on aspects and stereotypes of the other cultures. for example, you will not find a multicultural book written about like South Asia where it's about middle class South Asians. Instead, you'll find a book like Homeless Bird where it's about this poor 13-year-old girl, child bride who has all these things done to her and she's poor and da, 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 da. Now, you won't find a book about a rich kid from a third world country, even though there are many rich kids in third world countries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You will find the books because that is the perception North Americans have of the third world. And writing about a rich child from that culture would be, huh? You know, like people would think, what? You know, like they, it wouldn't jive. And so most of the stories you find are not about like middle class or rich, upper middle class kids in the other cultures, which of which there are many. They're about the poor because that fits into the stereotype of other cultures.
Yeah, everybody's a peasant, so we're going to write about peasants fundamentally.
Well, you kind of see that too in the mentality of some North Americans when Katrina happened. And I think some reporters started calling the people who had to leave their homes, leave New Orleans, they started referring to them as refugees,
mm-hmm.
which is an accurate term because they were seeking refuge and they had to be evacuated. But people, like Americans, balked. No, refugees are not American. Refugees come from other countries. They are to be pitied. They are from other cultures. They are not American. So instead, CNN, I remember, they made an issue of it, and they started calling them evacuees instead.
Yeah, I remember some of that fuss.
Yeah,
and
it was really silly.
Yeah, silly was exactly the word I was going to use.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing about the stereotype, thinking of the other culture as the basic peasants. When I was in Wisconsin in
mm-hmm.
the mid-1980s working on my degree, we had a woman come as a student to the library school there. She was Nigerian.
Uh-huh.
And one of the students there asked her in all seriousness what it was like wearing shoes for the first time. Because, of course, the image was this kid came from a village, went a grass hut, and was, you know, doing that whole thing. Well, she was a middle-class girl from Lagos whose dad was an engineer and mom was a doctor or something along
probably
that line.
Probably lived in a high-rise.
You know, and just the whole fact that there might be a city in Nigeria, and I may not have the country right, but, you know, the general gist of the story is correct. So this that kind of, as a friend of mine would probably say, a cultural imperialism at war there.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I've been doing in a lot of my stories, I try to really focus on the child. I mean, what the truth of the child would be.
Mm-hmm.
And irregardless, I mean, and the thing is, I actually see nothing wrong with being poor. Being poor, you can still have dignity. You can still have your pride. Belongings and possessions are not what gives you dignity. As long as you have enough to eat and as long as you have a roof over your head, you have the basic requirements, you can have a life of dignity. To me, that is not an issue. And in fact, when I went to Afghanistan, well, not Afghanistan, I went to Peshawar to meet my foster child, I actually had to try to really understand because the horror that they had gone through because when I actually visited them, I had been in Pakistan for about two weeks up before I went to visit him. And when I actually visited him, he was living in a mud house. But I looked around and I thought, actually, this isn't that bad. And the mud house was ingeniously built and quite effective, especially against cold and heat, I would imagine, in the summer. And I really didn't think he had it that bad until I looked at the emotional toil that they had been through. And that was that when I looked at it from that perspective, that's when I was able to get my story, The Roses in My Carpets, which is something I consider my best story out of all of the stories that I've written because it really does, what it really is about a boy who's a refugee. He needs help, but he has too much pride. He doesn't want help. And I guess that must have thrown some people when they were reading the story because that's something that any North American would identify with. Like, nobody would want to go on welfare. Nobody would want to take a handout. But they wouldn't necessarily think that other people from other cultures would feel the same way.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of that cultural imperialist thing going on there. There is an argument that I've heard made by, now again, this comes from me being in the Southwest for a long time, from Native Americans, that in fact only people of that culture should be writing about that culture. And, you know, certainly the gist of our conversation up to this point would sort of back up that argument, and yet I would you buy into that completely, that only as a Muslim can you write about Muslim culture? Is there any...
That's an interesting dilemma, and I have faced it. I think when I first started writing, I felt the same way as the Native Americans did, that really you cannot understand another person's cultural norms until you've actually lived in among them. Almost like, to me, it's almost a process where you take your own norms and slough them off, and then put on the norms of the culture you're identifying with for the story, even just for the purpose of the story and for the duration of the story. That's what I try to do. I don't think that that's the approach that should be taken. I don't think that only people from the culture should write about the culture. I think it can be done responsibly from outside the culture, but frankly speaking, there are very few books I could recommend where a non-Muslim wrote about Muslim culture and got it right. That's actually one of the reasons why I continued, despite all the rejection I received, because really they were portraying us wrong. And I was so angry that, there's like in writing, there's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of obstacles you face as a woman from another culture writing about things. You have to really get your mind around a lot of stuff. It's been really hard. I've been writing now for 16 years. And so there's been a lot of rejection. It would have been easier just to sit back and read good books. Much more fun. Instead of trying to write them. Now, but the thing was that the books that were coming out were just wrong. They were getting it wrong. And they were portraying it. They might have had good intentions, but they were getting it wrong. And that was one of the reasons that I kept through. Now, I actually thought it wasn't possible for a white person to be able to write about Muslim culture. That's really dumb, too, because there are lots of white Muslims. But to be able to write about Muslim culture when they're not Muslim, until I read one book. It's called The Bedouin's Gazelle by Francis Temple. I mean, I read this book, and I was expecting, once again, to be disappointed, and yet, here she had done it. She had actually written so honestly and so respectfully of Muslim culture, and she'd gotten it right. And I was really shocked. Unfortunately, twist of fate, she actually died right after she wrote that book.
Oh, serious.
Frances Temple, yeah, she died right after she wrote that book. But, you know, it was an eye-opener to see that it could be done, and it could be done respectfully. And in fact, I know an author who is not Hispanic, but she can speak Spanish so fluently, and she has lived among Hispanic culture so much that she, personally, I know she would write so respectfully and so accurately about the culture. She's actually, I think, got Scandinavian roots. And yet she can really, I think it can be done. But I think in doing it, the process you have to adopt is almost where you remove your own, whatever you believe in terms of your own standards and mores, and you put them aside and adopt the cultural mores and standards of the ones you are trying to write about, just even for the duration of the story. And you limit yourself to what the person in that culture would know. And what they would have had access to. And it's not easy, but it can be done.
Well, in a way, that's the old Franz Boas approach to anthropology, going back to Margaret Mead and growing up in Samoa, and I know I'm mashing up the title here and probably the people too. I was thinking when I started asking that whole line of questioning, I wasn't thinking of book. I did not have a specific book in mind,
mm-hmm.
but I was thinking about the movie director Ang Lee, who is obviously not a white guy from North America,
mm-hmm.
and who has done two movies that to me have just absolutely caught the American West. Brokeback Mountain being one of them, and the other a film almost nobody has heard of called Ride with the Devil.
Uh-huh.
That deals with the American Civil War, Missouri, Kansas, and all that. And I'm thinking, here's this guy from Asia, and boy, he just nailed it in both those films. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, it's a huge cooperative process and all that. But
mm-hmm.
I think
people who are from other ethnicities, when they live in a more dominant culture, it's easier for them to make that transition
mm-hmm.
because they are immersed in the dominant culture. They completely understand why everybody sees things the way they do, even if they personally disagree. I think it's that, because I could easily write from a white North American perspective. I would have no trouble.
Yeah, that was another question I was going to ask you.
Yeah, it's been
yeah.
In fact, honestly speaking, when I first started seriously writing, I thought those were the kind of stories I had to write, because when I first started writing, it was before this wave of multiculturalism
mm-hmm.
Kind of descended on the genre. And I really thought that in order to make it, I would have to write books about normal kids, like, you know, white mainstream. But it was the publishers themselves who asked me to write stories from the culture, from my own culture.
Mm-hmm.
And understandably, I mean, that's my niche kind of thing. But at the same time, I didn't want to make my stories into the kind of multicultural didactic stories I wouldn't have touched growing up. So what I try to do instead is just write the best darn story I can and people it with Muslim, South Asian kind of cultural characters.
Well, that's, you know, certainly it seems to be working. I mean, you had me in stitches when you were talking about the first chapter of your Muslim Child, and I'm convinced that all kids across the board are going to understand that, absolutely.
I think they will. I tell that story a lot, and the kids, universally, they just crack up. They find it really funny.
Oh, well, you know, mention a fart joke to a seven-year-old.
Oh, and, definitely.
You're
well,
there.
Even teenagers.
I was going to ask you at one time, you were talking about reading the book by the woman,
Frances Temple. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the note I've got to myself here is there any, do you do any review media? Is there any reviewer or review niche where, quote, multicultural books get a decent review from your point of view? Or, indeed, do you review books like that?
Well, personally, I haven't gotten into the reviewing, that whole thing. I haven't gotten into reviewing.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically I think that writing the reviews, I think you've got so much writing energy, and I try to expend it writing the fiction. I didn't set out to be a reviewer, and but that said, what I try to do is I try to steer people in, because I know that a lot of people are looking for books. I mean, a lot of people are very open-minded, and they want to include books that cover other cultures and show them respectfully, and they don't know exactly which ones are good, which ones aren't. So I on my own website, I made a list of Muslim children's books that I approve of and that I think represent the culture and the faith well. So that's what I've done. And I guess you could call that reviewing them. But I haven't done detailed reviews. In terms of other reviews, really my books are just reviewed within the general review journals, like Kirkus, School Library Journal, all the basic general review journals. And the funny thing is, I've always heard of Kirkus being so mean and hard, but they've always been kind to me.
Is there any of the, you know, the general review things, there's Kirkuson Library Journal and Canadian Library, just School Library Journal, anybody doing a particularly good job or?
Well, I can relate one anecdote that really ticked me off. It was for that book of mine, The Roses in My Carpet. When I wrote that book, it took me 4 years to write. It's a picture book.
Wow.
1,000 words. Took me 4 years to write. I really do consider it my best book. It won an international literary award in Poland. Okay, named after a Jewish children's writer from World War II. So now this book is my second book, and honestly, it really is good. Now, when that book went out, it was in between. It was after Russia had left Afghanistan and before the Taliban thing really became big.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, the timing of it coming out was in between news stories. People had kind of moved on. So I think that's one of the reasons why it didn't get some of the attention I would have liked. I met a reviewer who had reviewed the book. She worked with Booklist. I met her about 3 years, at least 3 years after the review. And I met her in Toronto at the ALA. And she remembered me. She saw my name tag and she said, "Oh, you wrote that book, The Roses in My Carpets." I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Well, I reviewed that book for you. I reviewed it for Booklist." And I said, "You did?" And then I told her how I was disappointed because here it was, as far as I'm concerned, it's my best book. It did not receive one starred review. Oh, and I said, "Well, you know what? It didn't get any starred reviews. I was really disappointed in that." And she said, "Well, you know what? I really wanted to give it a star. I really wanted to give that book a starred review, but I didn't because I wasn't familiar with the culture." You know, I was so mad. I was really, really mad. And, she remembered me. 3 years later, she'd reviewed the book, she remembered me. Now, other books of mine have received starred, and my book is, my work is starting to get noticed and everything. I mean, hence the invitation to ALA, but, I mean, that still is my best book, and it's in Canada. It's very well known. In fact, it's part of the curriculum in the Ontario school system. You can't go to a school in Ontario where it's not there, and they even use it for Remembrance Day, and because it deals with children in war. I mean, it's very well known, but here, in America, it hasn't received the same thing because it didn't get the starred reviews,
and it deserves
them. Yeah.
Well, we were, kind of dancing around that issue in New Orleans, the whole American approach to the Muslim world right at the moment is a little on the iffy side, shall we say.
Yeah.
Before we started the review, you and I were chatting about you make a differentiation between that phrase that I just used, the Muslim world, and Islam, and I wonder if you could kind of recap your conversation on that for us.
Sure.
I found it very interesting.
Well, basically, as far as I'm concerned, I've made it a policy. I will not defend the actions of Muslims. I mean, Muslims are just regular people. There's good, there's bad, there's in between all kinds of. There's good ones, smart ones, dumb ones, all manner of Muslims. What I do defend are the doctrines of Islam, because I have gone through them very rigorously and examined them, and I have found them to stand up to any philosophy in the world. Okay, and that is one of the reasons why, growing up here in North America, where I've got a choice of what faith I'm going to follow, I ended up back with my faith that I was born with, and I actually kind of chose it. So I will defend Islam because, to me, that is defendable. But the actions of Muslims, you know what? There's good, there's bad. If they do something right, that's fine. If they do something wrong, then it must be condemned. But what galls me sometimes is the fact that most Americans, they expect us to condemn the actions of other Muslims. I can't say enough. Like, I was on a politics forum for a while. And I kind of dropped off because I was constantly called upon to condemn the actions of Muslims, like bin Laden and stuff like that. And I already said, well, of course, what they're doing is completely wrong. It's like brutal. It's barbaric. It's all that. And that's not enough. And no matter how many times I would condemn it, it was never enough. They would always say, you're not condemning it enough. And I'm thinking, well, what do you want from me? When Tim McVeigh, white guy, you know, like that brush.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when he blew up the Oklahoma City, not all white American military types were branded as terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But when a few crazy Muslims do these things, we're all to blame. And I mean, Muslim groups have been condemning these things, especially in America. There's CareNet, which is a Muslim advocacy group. They have repeatedly condemned all of these things these actions that are being taken by radicals, and yet it's never enough. They say, we don't see them condemning it. We don't see it. That's because they're not listening. It's being done. But how many times are we supposed to condemn something?
Well, I'm hoping in the long run that books like yours and other books will have an effect somewhere. I long term, in the first interview we did, I said something in effect, if it were all the hands of the children, we'd probably be a lot better off.
Yeah, in some ways I think we would. Yeah.
So I want to, encourage you certainly to keep on writing. I have to go find a copy of The Roses in My Carpet now.
Oh, thank you.
you
can probably find it in the libraries.
I'll bet I probably can.
You probably can. It is available. It's available.
Yeah.
In fact, they'll bring it in if they don't have it.
Yep.
They'll bring it in. I know that book, it started out very low-key. It's become like a sleeper hit, where it's really been building in terms of the reputation over the years.
Good.
Yeah.
I will make sure that my granddaughter gets to read that, or both my grandkids, in fact.
Well, I hope so.
Well, Roxanne, I want to thank you so much for coming back to talk with us for a while. We got cut short in New Orleans, and this is certainly going to make for a much more interesting interview.
It was my pleasure.
And thanks again.
Okay, take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.